This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
This episode is brought to you by Smart Food Popcorn. Some decisions aren't the best, like skipping ahead in your favorite podcast. Think of all the banter you'll miss, the lore in the making. Luckily, Smart Food Popcorn is a no-brainer. Deliciously tasty and available in a variety of fun flavors. It's a smart decision every time. Smart Food. Add smart. To learn more, visit smartfood.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the BBC Music Magazine podcast. You can subscribe to the magazine by visiting classical-music.com or to our interactive iPad edition by visiting itunes.com. BBC Music Magazine is now an official Apple Music curator, and you can listen to our exclusive playlists by visiting applemusic.com/BBCMM. Welcome to the relaunched BBC Music Magazine podcast. I'm Oliver Condy, the magazine's editor, and with me today are deputy editor Jeremy Pound, reviews editor Rebecca Franks, and editorial assistant Freya Parr. This time we're going to be doing things slightly differently, starting with a quick look at the music news that's piqued our interest over the last couple of weeks. Then we'll be discussing what's in this month's magazine, the features, the cover CD, the recommended recordings, and finally we'll chat about some new recordings each of us has brought along. But first, it's time for a spot of news. Rebecca, what's caught your eye this week?
Well, there have been a lot of season announcements for orchestras and opera houses for what they've got coming up. And one that particularly caught my eye and that's been in the LA Times and the New Yorker is the Los Angeles Philharmonic, which has announced its 100th season. And it's been described as in the LA Times as saying no orchestra has ever come close to the ambition of this centennial season. Seems to be the general agreement. And it's a fantastic season because it has 54 commissions, 58 premieres, 61 living composers. It's also got 21 female composers and 27 composers of colour. And there's, if you start looking at the makeup of concert programmes, it's still very much dominated in the US and in the UK by male composers. And this is just a really exciting season because it's managed to open up what it's doing, but it hasn't. If, you know, you still want to hear all the composers from the classical canon, you know, they've got Esa-Pekka Salonen conducting a Stravinsky festival, they've got Lang Lang playing Beethoven piano concerto, Zubin Mehta conducting Brahms. So it's kind of managed to do everything in this one season. So I was just really excited by that.
And particularly in America, where you rely on a lot of private funding rather than public funding, you know, where the pressure would be from the individuals to program their favourite Brahms symphony, or, you know, this is actually quite an achievement to get the balance right.
Dare I say, though, that's the sort of programme that only an orchestra which does actually have quite a sizable endowment would risk doing.
And also, I think an orchestra that's decided to make a commitment to looking at diversity. And I think they've decided to do that because I think these schedules are made so far in advance. You know, artists who want to hear your Brahms symphonies and you want to hear Stravinsky. So, but they have made a commitment to say, okay, well, let's see how we can open up the programme.
It's inclusive without being sort of making a point of
yeah
a female composer season or a people of colour season. I like that one. They just incorporate it.
Exactly. Mm. I'm always slightly aware that a lot of orchestras in this country, again, because of the Arts Council funding, are actually pointing at their programme saying, look, we've got female composers, we've got composers of a, you know, different colour, different race, rather than, as you said, Freya, incorporating it, making a natural part of their season. But I think that, you know, over the next few years, that it will become more of a norm.
Hopefully.
Jeremy, what have you brought along this month?
Right, well, I'm going to start my story with a little audio clue. Right, well, that was the choir of King's College, Cambridge, in 1999, performing Rachmaninoff Vespers. And this is linked into the news that Stephen Clearbury, who is the director of music at King's, is to leave in 2019 after what will have been then 37 years in post. He actually began in 1982. Just to put this in a little bit of context, I remember when I was a chorister way back when, my choir, New College Oxford, did a joint sort of joint supper with King's College, and he was the choir master then. Now, I am not that far off 50 years old, just to give you an idea of just how long he's been in post.
Is that the longest a director of music has been in a post?
Surely.
I don't know, because Edward Higginbottom was at New College from 1976 to 2014, so you do the math. So, yes, he was there even longer, 38 years.
Right,
so.
Yes.
I think the thing is, though, once you get these great posts and you can shape the choir and, you know, such a fantastic chapel to work with and such great voices.
That, where do you go from there?
Yeah.
Well, these colleges are very well funded. And they, the other thing is that they tend to leave the director of music alone just to get on with it. You don't have...
That's the ideal job.
Unless you have occasionally a fussy chaplain who kind of wants to play around with what you're singing in chapel. Outside that, the sort of the stuff you're doing in concerts, etc., you have a fairly kind of broad brush to do what you want. And so it's a nice post.
Although he did have to teach first year undergraduates, I can tell you, having studied with them.
But as Richard Morrison says in the magazine Coming Up, it is a good excuse, I think, to shake things up. I mean, fewer directors of music are organists these days. I mean, Stephen Layton is a prime example over at Trinity. And the post does not stipulate now that you have to play the organ. So, you know, this is someone who can be a purely musical director and leave all the organ playing to the organ scholars, which could be a good move forward.
There's a whole host of candidates. I'm not going to kind of go into them now, but I'd be interested to see if they go for one of the sort of younger ones who's working in one of the Oxbridge colleges already and have been working with male and female voices rather than just boys' voices. Mm. So for the likes of sort of Sarah McDonald at Selwyn, for instance, might be a good choice, or Graham Ross, who's at Clare College, one of those.
That makes things up. Yeah.
I have no idea who the next person will be, and I don't think anyone does, really.
And it'll be quite interesting to see if they do think about whether they're going to have girls singing in the choir as well and break with that tradition that they've had at King's, because a lot of other places are starting to think about that. Maybe King's will too.
I think it'll be very interesting whatever happens.
It is a superb choir though still, isn't it? I mean, it really is quite something. The treble sound, I think, is extraordinary. I mean, it's a very clean cut sound, but I really like it, and I think it's maintained. I mean, yeah, I think he's done a remarkable job, really.
And as you heard from that recording just there, I mean, the acoustic in King's is second to none, because it's unlike some college chapels, which are actually quite small, and you have to work really hard at the singing to actually get something out. It's not like that. It's room enough for that, but it's not like St Paul's, where you can't do anything detailed because it just gets lost in this huge, great kind of wallowy sound. It's the perfect acoustic.
So talking of places of worship, the story I've brought is an interesting one, actually. Sajid Javid, the housing minister, has basically noticed that people who move into areas still have the right pretty much to complain about noises coming from established music venues or churches, bell ringing practice, that sort of thing. And basically they can put in force a noise abatement order. And he's basically righting a wrong, as he says in his own words. And basically it's now a lot tougher for people to move into an area, complain and stop, for example, the church clock chiming at night or the bell practice happening on a Thursday evening, which I think is a good thing. Obviously, brass band practice comes into it. And no doubt a lot of the venues are pop and rock venues that are quite noisy. But, you know, people do not have to fear, I think, as much as they used to about being shut down.
That's interesting, especially if you do move somewhere, yeah, and they've got bell ringers and practice going on. I mean, that's part of a tradition, isn't it, as well? That
I think if you have a problem with it, it should be like when you're moving into a new area, you look at the schools, you look at the environment, you look at everything that's around. And if that's a serious priority to you, you don't have bell ringers on a Sunday, then don't move there.
It's the house buyer's responsibility.
Exactly.
Just as you look at the size of the rooms and the sort of how many bathrooms and things you've got, you actually look at the environment as well. And it's quite right to. And it's absolutely... There have been one or two really unpleasant stories, actually, over the last 4 or 5 years of people who have come in and thought they owned the place and actually tried to shut down, you know, as you say, bell ringers from rehearsing on a Thursday evening or whatever it is. Mm. So I'm delighted to see this one.
Absolutely. I mean, that's not to say that one shouldn't control antisocial noise. No. I mean, that's a different thing,
Yeah.
And should the bell ring at 11 o'clock at night? Well, of course, that's going to be unacceptable.
But they don't.
Yeah. And as I read someone's letter who they wrote to the Financial Times, actually, a few months ago and said, I didn't move to the countryside for this. So people have a very, very warped view of what goes on in the countryside. Mm. I think they think that they're going to escape the city noise and live in some kind of false idyll. So yes, good news all round for that one. Freya, what have you been reading about this week?
Yeah, well, a big story. Ireland has a new opera company. No new opera sort of venue. That it's a travelling company, but it was announced actually back in 2010, but it's taken clearly quite a while to come to fruition. But they've got some really big names quite a few. So they have a programme with artistic partners who will help develop it and send it across the world. And they've got an amazing lineup of shows, and they're hoping to even do the Ring Cycle, which the first production of it in Ireland since 1913, which is pretty amazing. So, yeah, and apparently they want to tailor all their performances to the venues that they visit, so small or large. So it's exciting. It's very dynamic and diverse.
It's a lovely story to read, actually, because I remember over the years we've been on the magazine, on regular occasions we've been sort of reporting on the story tale of opera in Ireland. And it's actually really starting to improve because Northern Ireland Opera is doing superb
stuff now.
It's got a really good reputation. Wexford has come into its own, the Wexford Festival. Of course, that's only for a certain period of the year. Mm. So to actually have this kind of company, which is now travelling Irish National Opera, right from Donegal all the way down to Wexford, it's brilliant news. And you say the things have thrown their weight behind it are really, they're proper big names, so it's good.
I remember when we did that feature talking to musicians about what they would do if they had £10 million to spend, and Eilish Tynan, the singer, was saying, I want an opera company in Ireland, I want to nurture Irish talent, and I want to bring in international artists. And actually, this seems to be fitting the bill.
The next question, of course, is, are they going to get a nice new theatre, which would be phenomenal? But obviously,
that's what they need the £10 million for.
Quite. So that brings us to the end of our news items. So that brings us to the end of the news section, and now it's time to talk about what's in the latest magazine, the March issue of BBC Music Magazine, with Paul Lewis on the cover. And before we talk about it, here's an extract from our cover CD, which also features Paul Lewis. We're going to hear a clip from Schnitger's Concerto for Piano and Strings.
Thank you. That was Schnitger's Concerto for Piano and Strings, played by pianist Paul Lewis, and the BBC Symphony Orchestra under Tadaaki Otaka, which you can hear on our cover CD. Now, it's a fascinating cover CD this month because it revolves around Paul Lewis, and he has helped us choose four quite different composers, but it works superbly as a programme. So the works we have are Shostakovich's Piano Concerto No. 1, or some people better know it as Shostakovich's Concerto for Trumpet and Piano. Weber's Concertstück. Those are both for piano and orchestra, obviously. And then we have two solo works, Liszt's Funérailles and Au Cyprès de la Villa d'Este, number 2. And then we round off with the Schnitger. So we have basically 150 years' worth of music there, ranging from Weber is the earliest through to Schnitger at the end. Now, there's what makes it really interesting is actually the two sets of composers were linked in a little way, because Liszt arranged Weber's Concertstück, and also Schnitger was very highly influenced in his early career by Shostakovich. So it all works very well.
It is fascinating. And then actually what's great, as you said, is he's handpicked these works. This is the sort of the Paul Lewis disc that never was and now is. So it's a wonderful opportunity to hear him in something other than late romantic classical repertoire, which is great.
And I would really urge people to try and get to know the Schnitger, because it'll defy your expectations, because people think of him as being sort of a late Soviet difficult composer, but actually it's very lushly written, some lovely melodies in there. He was a very sort of multifaceted composer. You can hear that in this work.
It's quite approachable as well.
Very approachable, yeah.
Most terrific piece. Talking of Paul Lewis, he's on the cover of the magazine. Saving Joseph Haydn, taking Haydn out of the box, giving it a bit of a push like he's done with Schubert and Beethoven. I mean, those Schubert and Beethoven recordings that he's done for Harmonia Mundi have just been extraordinarily well played and well recorded and well received. And he's going to be doing the same over the next couple of years with Haydn, touring Haydn all over the world and also recording them again for Harmonia Mundi. So I'm delighted, because I absolutely love the Haydn piano sonatas. I mean, they're just full of so much wit and joy and surprise. I'm going to be controversial here and say I think I prefer them to the Mozart piano sonatas.
And we don't really hear enough Haydn, I don't think, in symphony concerts anymore, because people are a bit worried about not playing it on period instruments and modern orchestras. I mean, you do hear it. The CBSO is playing quite a lot of Haydn. And pianists as well tend to Mozart and Beethoven, so it'll be fantastic to hear Paul Lewis being completely immersed in it, as you say, touring around, because he just, you know, just focuses in on one composer so that he gives it that real attention and passion.
And I'm not going to give too much about the cover disc away, but what I quite like about it is that his thoughts on concert programming is that using Haydn, he'll often finish off with quite a jolly or humorous work. You don't have to have this major showpiece to round off a concert. You can actually finish off on a light note, for instance. That's quite interesting to read his thoughts on that.
And also, you know, because he's now one of the directors of the Leeds Piano Competition, he may set some very interesting programmes for the competitors. You know, rather than say, oh, you have to do a Chopin etude, or you have to do a Liszt B minor, whatever it is, you know, he could strip it back, really, and you know, really change things and make the competition exciting in that sense.
Yeah, definitely.
So, Freya, there's also some interesting features on some female composers in the magazine, tying in with International Women's Day on the 8th of March.
Yes,
tell us a bit about
indeed.
Those.
So it's a great opportunity, International Women's Day, to explore some of these lesser-known composers, particularly, I mean, so our main feature is on Florence Price, who was primarily composing around the beginning of the 20th century. African-American composer, wrote some amazing symphonies, and kind of towards the end of her life was finally getting the recognition she deserved. In a similar way to Lily Boulanger, who is our composer of the month, whose life was tragically cut short. It seems like both of them were creating these incredible works that were then cut short by their sort of shorter lifespans, which is really devastating, but it's a great opportunity to actually learn more about them from very different backgrounds, but around the same similar time. And then we look at Fanny Mendelssohn, who's in our Building a Library with her string quartet, who was around much earlier, so very different lifestyle, but she's lesser known for her string quartet works, but definitely...
I think what's missing are great performances of some of this music, because actually Florence Price's music deserves better advocacy, and I think a lot of these works have just been played poorly. just to get recordings out there. And then it's time that important orchestras and important labels took these pieces of music and gave them the time.
Florence Price's First and Third Symphonies would get so much airplay if there's decent recordings of them. The first one, Symphony No. 1, is very kind of... It's got a real Dvorak feel to it. You can tell they were influenced by the same kind of same influences. And then the third one is actually quite folky and it's wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I heard part of the first symphony in concert, actually. Tinike played it at the South Bank last year. But they only did the first movement, which is a real shame, actually, because I don't know why they didn't play the whole symphony. I don't know if there's a problem with getting hold of parts, although it had been recorded, so they must exist. But... it would be great to hear the whole thing in concert because it would work so well that, you know, every time you, instead of programming, say, Dvorak's New World Symphony, if you replace some of those with...
It is music which is just waiting to be enjoyed.
And not just orchestral music either. I mean, you know, as an organist, I was really interested in the fact that she was an organist herself and her organ pieces are terrific.
Yeah.
I mean, they're really fantastic, post-romantic, sort of 20th century style... preludes, sort of voluntaries, suites, fantasy, I think. They're terrific music.
Lili Boulanger, there are quite a few recordings. I mean, she wrote fewer, we have fewer surviving works, and there are good recordings of her music. But even then, you don't hear it that often. I mean, I know the BBC Symphony Orchestra, they're doing a total immersion day on Lili and her sister Nadia Boulanger next year. But it'd be great to hear even more of them.
Without good recordings, it's very rare that they... It's unlikely that they're going to...
Though I should point out that with Fanny Mendelssohn, half the point of us featuring it as a Building a Library piece is that there are a couple of fantastically good recordings of the string quartet.
Yes.
And particularly the one which features here is actually coupled with two of Mendelssohn's, Felix Mendelssohn's quartets. And it's a lovely disc because you can actually hear the way they sort of...
No spoiler alerts.
I'm not giving a spoiler alert. I've not said who it is.
You'll have to buy the magazine to find out. So let's move on to the recording of the month. And I think we should start with a clip first. Are we going to hear?
We're going to hear the Allegro Moderato from Mayakovsky's Cello Sonata No. 2. So that was a clip from our recording of the month, which features cellist Laura van der Heijden and pianist Petr Liminov. And it's a wonderful disc. So she won BBC Young Musician in 2012 playing the Walton Concerto. And she was just 15 when she won that. And she's waited until now to make her debut recording, which she's done on Champs Hill Records, who regularly turn out these really impressive projects and really support young artists and beautifully produced, beautifully recorded. And, she's done a programme, so it's called 1948, Russian Works for Cello and Piano, and it features Prokofiev's Sonata in C, this Mayakovsky Sonata, and then five pieces by Yuri Shaporin and a short prelude by Liadov. And I just like the fact that she's gone a little bit off the beaten track and taken us in, Prokofiev, name we all know, but she hasn't gone for the really obvious. She's really kind of thought about it in great detail, and she's waited until she felt really ready to do this and like she had really something to say with this music. And I think that just comes across beautifully. So that's why we decided to make it the recording of the month.
I love the confidence to actually, as you've just said, to put this programme together as a debut disc, though. I think it's really brave, and I love her broad tone. I mean, it's so deep and rich. I think it's a really, really fantastic disc.
Yeah, I think she's a very eloquent player, isn't she?
And the recording quality is amazing. It's really clear. And it's a very full sound, and you really can get the best out of her.
Mm.
Yeah, like you say, her tone, and it's very rich. Mm. It's lovely. Mm.
I think they do a really nice job. I think David and Mary Bauman, who run Champs Hill, make it such a supportive atmosphere for people going to record.
Yes.
When we spoke to Laura for the magazine, we've got an interview with her in the magazine, and she was just saying that, you know, was the whole thing was a really enjoyable experience, which is kind of what you want to hear for a debut recording.
Well, looking forward to reading about that in the March issue of the magazine. So we're going to move now on to the discs that we've all brought along. This is a first listen section of the podcast. Freya, what have you brought along this week?
So I've brought Alexander Melnikov's Four Pianos, Four Pieces. So basically, the premise of the disc is that he performs on pianos that are appropriate for the period and the composer. So I thought this might be a little gimmicky, but actually it's really varied in a very splendid way, and it's a very eclectic disc.
Should we hear a clip before
Yes. So we're going to hear a clip from the Schubert Fantasy in C major. That was Schubert's Fantasy in C major, played on a forte piano from around 1828. And I just love the percussive quality to it, and it sounds so warm, and it's like the piano that you'll learn to play on. But
how much do you find that you appreciate the differences between the pianos from hearing this disc?
I did in some. I personally wasn't a fan of the Liszt. It was too heavy sounding, particularly when
What was it played on?
It was played on a Bösendorfer.
Yep. Yeah.
And it just following the Chopin, which was so light, it just was a bit clumpy.
I got to agree. I didn't really like the Liszt piano. No. Adored the Chopin, the Erard, the 1837 piano, the real resonance and halo of colour you got. But yeah, I didn't really like the Liszt piano that much.
It's quite an interesting disc, though, isn't it? One which has almost been crying out to be made, this kind of whole idea of you can actually hear the difference.
I'd like to see it live. I'd like to see this concert live, actually, because I think half the thing would be watching these pianos, seeing these pianos. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if he's actually made a video of this.
He did it at the Wigmore Hall, but he only did it with three pianos,
didn't he, rather than four?
All the pianos were on stage at the same time, were they?
I think so, and then they sort of switched them around.
Because I think moving pianos on and off in at Wigmore would be quite complicated.
A real nightmare, yeah.
But I was slightly disappointed, I have to say, with the Steinway at the end when I heard this disc. I mean, it is a very, very small point, but I think it was the wrong repertoire to play on the Steinway for a start, and I think the Steinway does come off a little bit personality-less.
Yeah, it was a strange choice after all. Yeah, everything that had gone before.
Absolutely.
It feels a little bit anticlimactic after all the varied pianos before.
But I did like the idea, and his playing is fantastic the whole way through.
Yeah.
You know, he's such a fantastic pianist.
Oh, absolutely, and it reminds me of who's the pianist that did the Schubert impromptus on forte pianos.
Alexei Lubimov.
Yes, and he also did the Debussy preludes on two different pianos.
Yep.
You know, it's such an interesting thing to do because you play differently on different instruments, and you know these pieces take on such different hues and such different atmospheres.
Definitely.
Jeremy, what have you brought on for us to listen to?
Right, I'm going to let you listen to this first before I explain what it is.
Thank you.
That was Mein Herr und Mein Gott by Petrus Vasks, the Latvian composer. And it was sung by the Latvian Radio Choir, accompanied by Sinfonietta Riga, under the baton of Sigvard Klaver. I've become very enthusiastic about the music of Vasks ever since I listened to Renaud Capuçon's amazing recording of his Distant Light Concerto a few years back. Now, this disc is on Ondine, and I actually reviewed it for the magazine, for an in-brief review in the magazine, and it has completely captured my imagination. There's five works on it, some accompanied by orchestra, string orchestra, one work with organ, and everyone I have played it to says it is stunningly beautiful. It even stopped my family mid-conversation the other day, which is saying quite something. There's the two works for me which are the really standout works, so that one and at the end a work called The Fruit of Silence, but it is all hugely beautiful.
Yes, beautifully sung and beautifully played, but the orchestrations are really rich, aren't they? Cinematic almost.
The whole thing reminds me a little bit of Arvo Pärt. They have a very similar background. Actually, Vasks is Latvian, whereas Pärt is Estonian, but they both kind of grew up under Soviet Russia. Mm. Vasks had a miserable time. He had to join the Soviet army, hated it. And then sort of, so when the Soviet Union disintegrated, it was a bit of a liberation for him. You could describe his music as minimalism, but it's not just that. More of his music you listen to, actually, he stretches a lot beyond that. This is just this bit sounds quite minimalist, but other stuff of his is not so much.
Mm. I really enjoyed this disc as well. It was one that made me sort of stop in my tracks.
Yeah.
Unexpectedly so, actually, because the music seems quite simple, but it's more affecting than you think it's going to be, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. Doesn't do a great deal. As you heard in that passage, the choir doesn't move an awful lot, and actually most of the movement is in the strings underneath, a bit like Fauré, actually.
Yeah, and there's the odd sort of surprising harmony that suddenly comes in. You know, the layering of some of the harmonies is just so exquisitely done. It's very beautiful.
It's lovely stuff.
So I'm going to talk about my disc now. It's actually a recording I reviewed for the brief notes pages in the magazine, and it's the Britten and Hindemith Violin Concertos performed by Arabella Steinbacher with Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra under Vladimir Jurovsky. Absolutely mesmerising. The ensemble is incredible. Her sort of attack, her tone is just extraordinary. And the colours that Jurovsky brings out from the Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra is quite something. It works so well together. Let's hear the second movement, which is the Vivace. So we're going to hear the beginning of that. Such a wonderful, crunchy tone that she gets,
I think. It's really spiky playing, isn't it? But really playful as well, somehow.
Yeah, absolutely.
How well does it go with the Hindemith Violin Concerto? Because, of course, Hindemith's a composer who doesn't get really sort of fair treatment, doesn't
no,
he?
No, they're not similar, but they're in a sort of similar style, and she employs a very sort of similar approach as well. It's very playful and very virtuosic. Hindemith's obviously, you know, is a little bit more modernist, but it's still a very approachable concerto. Wonderful discovery. And again, the Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra and Steinbacher just work so well together. I mean, they sound as if they've been playing together for years, and I don't know whether they have, but that's what it sounds like. And
there's
recorded
such clarity of sound, and her playing is so present.
Yes, the recorded quality is fantastic. They've got a superb set of engineers.
Yeah,
clearly,
Pentatone is doing some really good things. Sort of, it's always been putting out some good things. They did that big Wagner cycle with Marek Janowski, but it's sort of changed in recent years, and they're just really bringing on board lots of artists, nurturing the talent that they've got, and just coming up with some really fantastic recordings.
They have.
Care about every detail.
Well, I mean, Steinbeck has been one of theirs for ages, actually. She's part of the furniture, and they've nurtured her, but they're bringing on some... they've just signed up... they've signed up Pierre-Laurent Aimard, haven't they?
Alisa Weilerstein.
So it'd be interesting to know what...
Arabella Steinbacher actually joined them when Julia Fischer moved over to Decca, and she was seen as a sort of natural replacement, and it's worked a treat.
Mm. It has worked a treat, actually. Rebecca.
Yes.
Your turn.
So I have brought along another cello disc from another BBC young musician, Sheku Kanny Mason, who won in 2016, playing the Shostakovich Cello Concerto No. 1. And he was signed up by Decca, and he's taken quite a different approach in a way to Laura, in that he's made his debut recording, which is the one that I have brought along, and he is playing with the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra and their conductor Mirga Gorazhenitsyna, and I think we could hear an extract from that from the Shostakovich, from the Moderato. So that was the Moderato from Shostakovich's first cello concerto, and it's the centrepiece of this album, which is called Inspiration. So it takes Sheku Kanny Mason's kind of inspirations, his love of Pablo Casals, of Rostropovich, Jacqueline Dupré, pieces that he played when he was a younger cellist. And so we've got Saint-Saëns' Swans, Casals' Song of the Birds, I've got some Bob Marley and some Leonard Cohen as well, arrangements. So he's taken quite a different approach to programming to Laura van der Heyden. And it seems to have paid off, because he has, since it's been released, it's entered the top 20 of the pop charts as well. So
he's been a lot of publicity for it, hasn't he? Actually, he's been.
They have done a good.
They've done a very
good PR
thorough job, haven't they?
Yes, they have.
But the Shostakovich was the concerto he actually won the competition with.
Yes, yeah, and actually, I've heard him play it live twice last year. Once with the National Youth Orchestra, which was a good performance, and then I was at one of the performances up at Symphony Hall where they've taken some of this recording from, and it was just such a wonderful concert, and it was packed out, and he had really developed even in those like 3 months, I think it was, or maybe no, it was longer than that, maybe 6 months in between hearing him play, and he'd really developed and matured even in that time. And there are moments on the recording in the first movement where I don't think it quite comes off, and it was somehow, some of the tempo choices are a bit strange, but live it sort of didn't seem to, I didn't notice that so much.
He's a very joyful player, isn't he?
He's
really in the moment.
Yeah, and I think that movement as well is very, very moving.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see where Decca takes him.
Well, I think he might give us a little couple of clues in the magazine itself, actually, because we interviewed him for a Music to My Ears interview where they tell us about their favourite music. And I'm not going to give anything away, but he specifically singles out one composer who's not on this opening disc, whose music he particularly is fond of. And I wonder if we might go in that direction. Again, you'll have to buy the magazine to find out who it is.
Exactly.
Little teaser.
I think that wraps up the podcast for this month. Thank you all for listening. We're going to be doing this podcast every month, so do catch us when we'll be talking about the April issue next time. But we're going to leave you with a clip from our March issues cover disc, and we're going to lead out with the final few moments of Shostakovich's Piano Concerto No. 1, performed by Paul Lewis. Thank you for listening to this BBC Music Magazine podcast, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Fletcher. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at classical-music.com or simply head to iTunes.